This is CliffCentral.com.
Take a big deep breath. It's Tuesday morning. Stretch and yawn. All right.
Yes.
We love animal stories.
Yes.
Well, I mean, we like it when the animals get revenge on humans. And the last couple of weeks, we've talked about these fearsome creatures that used to live in prehistoric times.
The baboon who was finally captured yesterday.
Oh, the Northcliffe baboon?
Yes, he's been captured.
That's good news. But how's this? Apparently, there is a giant tick that can hunt you through the forest. Now, you know, ticks are so gross because they latch onto your dog's backside and they get all fat and blue and they swell
to
like...
Those are the different types.
20 times their size and it's just gross.
Yeah, you get those ones that make like a sack that you can squish.
Oh, my God.
These are those ones that...
A tick.
...look like spiders.
Oh.
So it's giant in this case. This article gives you a comparison of a normal tick compared to you.
Yeah, so it's like the giant four one. Or five times the size of a normal tick.
Yeah, so it actually covers ground quite quickly.
Oh my God, it can run?
Well, okay. So let's just calm ourselves firstly by saying that these ticks occur mostly in the Mediterranean.
Okay.
However, they are spreading. They've been found in the Netherlands and in Germany, and they're spreading through forests.
Right.
So most ticks that we know of, they know that when you're in the woods or in the outdoors, right? Because they can smell your carbon dioxide every time you exhale. And that's how mosquitoes find you too.
Right.
Through your carbon dioxide.
And you can't stop breathing to stop attracting these
exactly.
things.
Exactly. Once they know that you're nearby, these are normal ticks, right? They hop onto the end of a leaf and they wait with their tiny front legs out, as if praising the heavens. And then should you or another animal pass by, they just latch onto you for a ride.
Well, they are praising the heavens that you come along.
Yes.
And suck your blood.
Now, these ticks, which are called hyalomma ticks, they prefer a more active hunting method.
Oh, my God. All right.
They ID you by your chemical scent.
Yeah.
They can also recognize a potential host visually from up to 30 feet away, and they will run along the ground to chase you down.
That is horrendous.
The vibrations you cause as you walk and the heat from your body helps hyalomma ticks track you too.
And they can chase you.
They can follow you for 10 minutes or even more, covering distances of up to 325 feet.
Now, I would imagine if there are 20 of these ticks in a specific area, all 20 of them follow you.
Yeah, exactly. Oh. One of them's going to get to you first.
Oh.
So to give you an idea, a person who's like 5'5" would need to run nearly 190 miles to cover the same relative distance.
Oh, man. Oh, man. This is horrible.
So, yes, they are spreading, and it is a concern because they obviously are capable of carrying various diseases. The one disease that these carry is Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever.
Oh, can this get any worse?
It's not a good thing that's happening right now.
Nasty.
Bacteria, they carry a type of spotted fever. So it's really scary. I don't have a good ending to that story,
well,
I'm afraid.
Then don't lie to us. I mean, it's fine. Just tell us the truth and we'll deal with it. Get ready for ticks that can hunt you through the forest. What a horrible thing to wake up to this morning. Ugh.
Mm. So the problem and the reason why they're spreading so quickly is because they catch rides on migratory birds, which have now spread them into Germany, Hungary and Russia.
Really?
So who would have thought that when there are things like Ebola and...
Don't we have enough to deal with?
Yeah.
Now we're going to be hunted by ticks.
It just makes me itchy.
Oh, what a... Have you ever found a tick on yourself?
I've had tick bite fever. A tick bit me on the back of the neck. Needless to say, I was lying on a golf course on a blanket looking up at the stars. So I kind of invited it. But the...
We used to play on the lawn as kids all the time. It's the lawn. It's the grass. It's the one place kids play.
Yeah.
You don't think you're in trouble on the grass, and then for all you know, there's a tick latching onto you somewhere.
Mm.
Pretty gross. All right. Well, there's something to think about first thing in the morning.
Yes.
apparently, there are benefits to owning a pet.
Well, the fact that it gets ticks, if we're not going to talk about.
No, but there are benefits to having a pet, and, yeah. and some of them are emotional, and some of them are physical benefits in terms of like going for walks and running and stuff like that that we already know. But tell us about the obvious benefits.
So there's now empirical proof. A study has found that dog ownership is linked to improved heart health for humans. And given that heart disease is the leading cause of death globally, this is really important. It does raise the broader question of how pet ownership affects human longevity. Pets can actually create health in humans.
Yeah.
The one way is by motivating you, giving you a reason to get up and get moving. You know, natural everyday movements, so taking your dog for a walk, or just the fact that you have to get up to feed them, ensure that they've got water available, look after their bedding, etc. That's all very good, especially in terms of mental health, which we'll be speaking about a bit more. So your pets basically provide nudges to everyday movement. The other thing is giving you a sense of purpose, you know, giving you a reason to wake up in the morning. There are people who are experiencing poorer health, including the aged, or long-term mental illness, chronic diseases. And the studies showed, that people were using words like, they need me to feed them or they'll die, or he would pine for me terribly. And so, it helps a lot when you look at the key risk factor of suicide. The fact that people actually don't want to offer themselves because they have animals to, who are depending on them.
Well, did you ever watch that Ricky Gervais Afterlife? Yeah, I mean, in that Afterlife series, I think the opening scene is him, he wakes up and his wife who's died, he's watching her video message and he has to feed the dog.
Mm-hmm.
Because feeding the dog is the first step he takes to recovery and to getting over her. It's really interesting. I often think, because I live on my own and I've got a dog, that it gives me the feeling that there's something waiting for me at home.
Yes.
And it's probably a little thing, but it makes a difference. And I do have to feed him in the evenings and feed him in the mornings, and it's important.
You're accountable.
Right. Because otherwise I'm just not accountable to other humans.
Yeah. I mean, if you had to just pull over on the side of the road and take a nap the whole night, somebody would know, and that would be your animals.
Right.
You know. So then there's also the one thing that we do know already, and that's that if you stroke your animals, specifically cats, it improves your stress levels and reduces your heart rate. And it's been found that co-sleeping with pets may actually improve some people's quality of sleep. Again, I know because I'm alone. Firstly, what's really interesting is, on the day that my mom had her brain hemorrhage, one of my cats, who I've had for 10 years already, or 10 or 12 years, had never done it before, but she came and lay on my chest when I was in bed. So yeah, that was very comforting. Yeah. And she's done that every single night since then. The other thing is having my little alarm dog, Joey, who's a miniature pincher, next to me. I know that he would hear if there was somebody breaking into the house. So you feel like you can fall asleep. Mm. You don't have to worry about not having that extra set of ears in the house.
Yeah.
And then lastly, pets help a lot with belonging and commitment. So, you know, you think about people, an old lady who has a dog, but she takes it to the park to have a walk.
Mm-hmm.
And she meets up with other people. It can spark, conversations. You feel like you're part of a community.
Did you say conversations?
Maybe I did.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's what I heard.
Conversations.
Conversation. Yeah, sure. Yeah. You need some of that. That's good.
So, yes, it helps people with long-term mental illness, autism, and the homeless as well.
How so?
Having a companion.
Oh, okay. I didn't.
And you'll often find that the homeless look after their pets even better than they do. There's actually a guy in my area. He's got two quite big dogs. Mm-hmm. They're called Blackie and something else.
It's Blackie. Blackie's such a good name for a black dog, right?
And these, yeah, and these dogs are absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
And I often go into, if I'm on my way to spa or whatever, I'll go and buy some dog food, and he's always grateful for that.
Yeah, I'm so grateful I grew up with pets around me, because, you know, there's just something about, you know, I grew up with dogs, and just your childhood memories are tied into these happy and grateful and just always around you.
Well,
you
know, they dogs. Say, I mean, maybe this is something that we can get into in a discussion with experts, but they say that if people treat animals badly, they'll usually treat humans badly.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something about that too, that if you meet someone and they have a pet and they're nice to their pet and their pet is well adjusted and socialized, that they probably have a calm life.
Mm.
They're not aggressive. They're friendly people. Mm. They're hospitable. You know, they're the kind of people you might want to get to know. Whereas if someone has a nervous, frightened dog who looks like it's abused, they're probably shit people.
I've dated someone who hated my dog, little Joey.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you broke up with him.
I'll tell you what, it puts a strain on the relationship.
I bet.
Huge, a daily strain.
You know, one of the images that still stick with me to this day, and I was probably 10 when I saw this, was when Hurricane Katrina hit.
Mm-hmm.
And with all of the news coverage, I can't even remember what news show I was watching. And there were these people who were not wanting to leave because they had to leave their pets behind.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, evacuation was like, no, only humans. And there were a whole bunch of people who were protesting.
Yeah.
Saying, rather than I'm going to stay here and all of this rubble and all of this mess, if it means I'm going to have to leave my pets behind.
The same happened with Chernobyl.
It was beautiful to watch.
Yeah. And with Chernobyl, just from what I got from the series, they had to leave all their animals behind. And then troops had to come in afterwards and shoot and kill these animals because they were just starving or preying on each other. And in fact, there are still some Chernobyl dogs around, and there is a community group which goes around and gives them their vaccinations and sterilizes them. So eventually the population of this group will die out. But there is someone looking after the Chernobyl dogs.
Yeah. Mm. Well, apparently, I mean, this is interesting. On my timeline over the weekend, we talk about animals. Ricky Gervais put out a thing, and this came up as like a 4 year ago memory on my timeline. He said, if you enjoy seeing an animal terrified or in pain, you're a cunt.
Sounds right. You know, I've oddly now come to enjoy my memories. I used to cringe and hate them, but now it's like, let's see what messy thoughts I had on this day.
Oh, right. Your Facebook
bad. Sure. It is really bad. But they remind you about some fun things.
I suppose you eventually you get over yourself and you stop worrying about what other people think. It makes you happy to know that you had good times.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. What else is happening?
Well, Leanne, it seems like you in this room are technically the happiest and healthiest person here.
No.
Get I'm ready gonna, to dismiss that.
Yeah, I'm going to say that's wrong.
According to a new study done at the London School of Economics, women who have never married and don't have children are the most content and outlive their married counterparts.
No, you see, what happened with me was I did get married.
And that's what tainted you. Otherwise, you would have been
so exactly
happy. Ruined her.
The relationships of my life. Yeah.
So Paul Dolan is a behavioral science professor at the London School of Economics, and he's written a book called Happily Ever After, and he's analyzed a bunch of data, and that's how he's now come to the conclusion and found that married people said they were happier overall, but only when their partner was within earshot. He says married people are happier than other population subgroups, but only when their spouse is in the room, when they're asked how happy they are. When the spouse is not present, well, they're just honest about how miserable they are. I don't know. Sure. You can dispute this, but hey, this is what he says. He continues to say, we do have some good long data following the same people over time, but I'm going to do a massive disservice to that science and just say, if you're a man, you should probably get married. If you're a woman, don't bother.
Oh,
jeez.
Well, yeah, that's sort of weird because I think men are more dependent on women as they get older than women are on men.
That's actually a good point you raise, because he says married men take fewer risks and calm down and therefore are healthier than their single counterparts. Whereas women did not see the same benefits. Women's health was mainly unaffected by marriage, but middle-aged women reported more mental and physical problems than single ones. So he says you take less risks, you earn more money at work, and you live a longer life. She, on the other hand, has to put up with that, and she dies sooner than if she never married.
Oh my word.
Wow. Okay, well there we go, ladies. Just don't get married.
Screw you, Beyonce.
We won't put a ring on it.
Hell, you want to live long? You want to be happy? Just don't get married.
Do it.
And let some man into your life.
Just don't do that at all. Despite all of this, though, despite the fact that never getting married may be better for women overall, there are, you know, we have to be honest, there's still some stigmas attached to, you know, people who are over 40 and not married. And it's like, why? Why aren't you? But now you have a new thing to stand by. It's for my health and my happiness.
Yeah, I'll live longer if I don't marry you.
All right. There are probably a 100 things, maybe even 1,000 things that I've seen happen in movies that don't actually happen in real life. But you tend to think, and until I'd been to America, I thought that this is actually what Americans did.
Yeah.
Like, for example, like Americans just leave their keys in their cars wherever they go.
They just jump
out of the car, or else they throw the key to someone else and someone else just parks their car without stealing it. And in South Africa, if you left your key in your car, you wouldn't have a car.
And if you're stealing a car in America, you can just pull down the sun visor and the keys might be there.
Yeah, right.
There are a lot of these conversations happening online, and it's a bit of a trend at the moment with, you know, Americans in real life versus what they're like in movies.
Mm-hmm.
So these are some of the tweets. Do Americans complain about fluorescent lights in real life as much as they do in TV? Do Americans really have 13-year-olds babysit their kids? Or is that just a movie myth?
That's a little odd, actually.
Well, why do Americans in movies always say they're going to Europe? Europe's a big place. Where are you going?
Yeah, but they also say they're going to Africa.
Yes, they do.
Africa's an even bigger place than Europe, and they never say exactly where. I'm off to Africa.
Yeah.
The motherland.
I've also found Americans who was my tenant at one point. He said, I've been to South Africa before. It was the Congo.
No.
No, please. Really?
Do Americans really eat chicken and waffles?
See, I never understood that, but I know some restaurant chains that offer that.
Do Americans actually eat pancakes for breakfast every day? Or is that just me watching too much TV?
That they do. I can vouch for that. I went to a hotel 2 years ago when I was in America, and they have waffles and syrup for breakfast.
Well, I suppose even at McDonald's here, you can get pancakes and syrup for breakfast.
Good. So they do waffles, pancakes, and they put like ice cream and syrup on that for breakfast. I know Sia likes this, but it's breakfast. Come on.
You're identifying as Japanese from this morning, Leah, and I'm now going to identify as American.
Do Americans really clap and cheer in the cinema?
South Africans do.
Yes, we do. Yeah.
Remember the days when we clap when the plane landed?
They did still do that too.
After a bumpy flight, have you never done that? Where you thought, we are tickets. There's a moment sometimes when you land safely, you start to clap.
Yeah, South Africans do. We clap at stupid.
Oh, yeah.
We're in no position to criticize.
Do Americans really open their doors without checking to see who it is first?
Yes.
Ding dong, open door.
It's such a far removed concept because, you know,
if someone knocks, firstly, we don't have anyone knocking on our door.
And also to what we see a lot depicted, and which is partially true in some cases, you know, these houses with no fence and the doors are unlocked, even though they might be closed. So that is such a far removed concept for me who grew up in South Africa. It's like, I need 3 barriers to entry first.
I mean, if I was sitting in the house and someone knocked on my door, I'd just grab myself. Because how the hell did they get in?
Yeah.
Okay, some more. Do Americans really put photos of their crush on the inside of their locker? Or is that just a TV thing?
Oh, I did that at school.
Oh, did you?
It's actually
you had a photograph of someone in your locker.
Such a geeky thing.
You did?
Well, two parts to that. Firstly, I just wanted to seem cool because I also had a mirror in mine.
Of course you did.
Of course.
But then secondly, I was still that guy hiding that I'm gay. So I wanted to be like, oh my gosh, look at me. And I had like Victoria's Secret models in the inside of my locker.
Oh no, you didn't.
Yes, I did. I had Salita E. Banks and Tyra Banks. And what's her name? Miranda Kerr. Meanwhile, I was like, did you see Miranda Kerr strut on the runway? It was so fabulous. I couldn't care less about what, how they looked.
Well, you know what, Sia, everybody does their thing, hey?
Had to go through a boys' high school in that way. Had to make it happen.
Yeah, yeah. Funny thing is probably none of them really thought that you were interested in any of those girls in your locker.
No, like, that's why I didn't understand when I eventually came out at school, there were some people who were shocked. I'm like, are you Stevie Wonder? Are you not okay? Like, what is going on? It's so freaking obvious, but anyway.
People also, they like to claim their little piece of territory, right? So they stick up pictures that are theirs or they
put like putting artwork on your suitcase.
Sure.
Your pencil box.
Yeah, you own your space.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've never really liked that, though.
But do Americans do that in every school? I don't know.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Because as well, you know, a lot of these things we got from these typical 90s sitcoms.
Yeah.
You know, everyone living in the same apartment block.
Exactly. And all the friends living together.
Yeah, and fame, and we'll go to school and we'll sing in the corridors and there'll be the jocks.
And I love everyone always gets along even though they live together. We know that's nonsense. You're going to fight with people all the time if you live with them.
Here's an interesting one. Do Americans really wear their shoes inside their house? Or is that just a myth of Western television? And that's obviously coming from a point of view of somebody maybe in the Far East who doesn't...
Where you take your shoes off?
Yeah, exactly.
In your house?
It's not a thing for me.
I never thought about that, actually.
Yeah.
I know that in England and in Britain, it's a thing, and that's got to do with mainly the weather and the snow. You take off your shoes and your boots, and there's like a special wet room where you can put everything.
Oh, right. But I do have some people, I've been over to some people's houses and they prefer people not to walk in shoes. And I just think it's so icky. I don't want to see people's toes.
Well,
I just don't. Leave that on, please.
I was at school with a Lebanese guy whose mom was super fussy in the house. The carpets were these long pile, white fluffy type carpets.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to take our shoes off before we went in. But again, getting back to the tidying up series we were talking about. What's her name? Sorry.
Marie Kondo.
Marie Kondo. She cleans her shoes every day and even underneath her shoes.
That's too much admin.
Yeah. We just... Also, you know, this is Africa.
Yeah. We
live on farms and things. We're not, you know, worried about putting our shoes in the house.
Well, we get ticks.
Please don't talk like that.
This is all. It's all links back. It's all about ticks.
I'd just gotten over that.
Right.
Well, also, just on a different story now. Welcome to 2019, folks. When the rise of online dating is apparent, it only makes sense now that we have dating stylists who help people date online.
So do they style you just for the photograph or for the actual date?
Yes, they'll style your online profile. They'll tell you what words work on your profile. They'll tell you what sort of photos will work. They'll tell you what to say. And this is now a proper career. There's a company called Dating Transformation. Particularly, though, this company helps male clients for 8 weeks stretches in what they refer to as a dating boot camp to help people
date online.
Mm.
All right. So what do? They fix you up physically? Do they do makeup and hair?
Well, no. It's actually all your online dating profiles. So they will take and select your new online profile photos.
Mm-hmm.
They'll also put together your biography and how everything is written for you on your dating profile. And sometimes they'll even go to the extent of initiating online chats and texts with your prospective dates.
I have to tell you, this is a good idea.
Yeah.
Because people don't know where they look good. I mean, you don't know. You need someone objective to choose.
Yeah, but also
this.
People need help, man.
Yeah.
If I look at Tinder and the quality of people on there, people need help with this. They really do.
You think about it. You just mentioned Tinder in particular. Tinder reports that there are more than 1 billion swipes recorded on the app every single day. And now this company is climbing into the dating industry, which makes about $3 billion a year. So, I mean, hey, if not, why not? If you can help someone consult you and say where you should pose and what you should say, then it absolutely works. So far, this company has worked with someone who is 25 years old, and they've even gone up to working with someone who's 75 years old.
Sure.
They say the same way you'll onboard a clothing stylist, why not onboard someone to help you style your online profile?
Ruth says there's a bunch of Jewish men who could do with this dating bootcamp. This sounds awesomely hilarious. I think there are a lot of men full stop. Men don't know how to behave a lot of the time, and they don't know how to put their best foot forward. And we've talked about this before. You get these guys who are like involuntarily celibate, and that's a whole other level of crazy. But essentially, there are men who just don't know how to be attractive.
Mm.
They don't know how to make it look like they're not a complete psychopath.
They seem to be copying each other. You know, it's profile after profile that I see where they've used similar photographs because they think that that's cool.
Guys are so dumb. They'll put up a picture of them in their car.
Them next to their car, just their car.
Or them with like three or four of their mates. You can't tell which one of them is them.
Yes. They've caught a fish.
Oh my goodness, yes. Look at this as an example. It's it's just one photo. This is the same guy.
A fish.
He had originally posted himself just like, oh, catching a fish, and that's so great. But you know, if you are depicting yourself online, that might not come off as the best
representation.
So is
that the transformation?
Yeah, and that's him afterwards.
Yeah, so it's from a photo where he's completely covered his head and eyes with
sunglasses
and hats.
Yeah.
And in the other one, he's just wearing normal reading glasses. He's smiling. He looks approachable. He doesn't have a hat on. Also, yeah, don't hide your baldness with hats. I have no problem with baldness.
Yeah,
absolutely
but
none.
Guys, you see, a lot of guys are very sensitive about this stuff. So they reckon, oh, if I'm short or if I'm bald or if I, I'm old or if I'm not ripped.
Mm.
No one's going to want me.
Yeah, we don't want your shirtless photos either.
But,
thanks.
But actually,
oh, I do.
People would like to. But people would like to see what they're dealing with. So don't hide it.
Mm.
Otherwise, it's really not going to work out.
And also photos of you drinking. I don't know.
For you, that's a must.
But I don't know.
You see, so.
No, clearly not.
There are some tips that these companies offer. So they'll, for example, say the photo that you use is absolutely key. You know, the more brighter the photo is, it comes off as more playful and lighthearted. That works better online. Also, when it comes to writing your biography on these dating sites around your profile, don't use generic and corny things like, I like long walks
on
the
beach.
Oh, God. But
or a big no-no is don't post your CV as your profile. I didn't know people do this.
Eyes are massively important. You cannot connect with another human unless you look them in the eyes. Like,
and, you know,
from the point of view of a complete stranger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I know they say don't judge a book by its cover, but I can see immediately whether I'm going to like a person or not.
But Leanne, I think that notion totally doesn't work in this day and age where you are literally judging a cover, though. What substance of the person can you get when you're looking
if
at a Tinder
profile? If
their eyes
are too close together or too far apart, it's a no-no.
Okay.
It's a no-no. I'm sorry.
Where are you
it's
getting
not
going
to work. I won't even like you as a friend.
Where are you getting that from? Right, if my eyes are too far apart.
It's a genetic thing.
It says what to you?
It's too far apart. You know, I just really don't want to offend people. I could get really specific.
Come on.
Go ahead.
Let's hear it.
It's a bit.
This is exciting.
I don't know. Hillbilly-ish. Sorry. This is why I didn't want to get into it, you know?
I didn't know that.
I like this. Come on. Tell us more.
No, Leanne, let your chest free.
Because in our class, we learned that you can fit one eye between the other two eyes. That's how you know the spacing is right.
Okay.
Oh, I never thought of it that way.
If you take a picture of someone and you trace the outside of their eye in terms of the actual eyelid, and you put that between the other two, you should have three.
Hmm.
Any more than that?
If it takes up a little more space, is what she's saying is like not for her.
Yeah, if you can fit two eyes in there, I don't think we're gonna be dating.
Well, a little bit. I like some wide eyes. I do.
I think all the more better to see you, darling.
All the better to see you. Isn't that what the wolf says?
I think it's beautiful. Really? It's endearing.
Jesus.
And I know it might come across as very woo-woo, but I don't believe, you know, there are some people who have just missed out on the genetic lottery. And that's fine. There's nothing you can really change about it or debatable however much money you can spend on yourself. Right. But it's also about making an effort.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
I'm more inclined to date someone who might be stereotypically ugly, but if they take care of themselves, I could overlook a couple of things.
Yeah, they are. I mean, it's the whole package. If you're going to put up a photograph of you in a washed out Springbok shirt at a braai sipping a castle out of a can, it's not going to work for me.
Yeah, that's not hot.
No.
So what's hot to you now? If you were to be on Tinder, what type of man would you rather gravitate to?
More of a professional look. So wearing a collared shirt.
Mm-hmm.
Not a selfie of you wearing a collared shirt on your way to work, where you probably sell Trelador.
Oi. Very specific.
Such an honest,
very specific
way of living, though.
Sure.
You know, it's a career, Leanne.
Yeah.
No?
She knows what she wants.
Okay.
I just can't see much of a conversation happening there, you know?
This is what she does.
Oh, I think you have, like, slim
She's picky and choosy, and very. She's not just going to be anyone's girl. Good for her.
Yeah.
Good for you, Leanne.
And then,
thanks.
And then I'm called superficial for wanting to design my own babies.
You are. You are superficial.
Leanne says she doesn't want any sales reps for.
Don't you start. We know you're superficial. All right. Let's get into mental health. Come on. Let's do this. I said we would talk about this morning. It's always a good thing to discuss, especially in a country like ours where, first of all, many, many more people than you think are suffering from mental health issues. It's time we talk about some of the more specific stuff. One of those topics you can never discuss enough because – if you're like us, you always have questions. We've discussed anxiety and depression, the psychological effects of crime on our mental health. Remember, we did that just the other day. And we've got all those conversations for you on cliffcentral.com. You can go and look them up. But the topic of mental health and raising awareness has become increasingly important. And unfortunately, stigma, misconception prevent those in need from getting the help that they might require. You know, even having help for the future. Now, this morning we've got a specialist psychiatrist, Dr. Gwen Tognani, who's here to give us some advice and knowledge about some of the mental health issues that we've heard about, but we don't always understand, so that we can talk about these things sensibly, and maybe you even can be more helpful than detrimental to someone who's going through some issues. So first of all, Dr. Gwen, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's such a pleasure to have you here. First of all, we've spoken about mental health issues before on this show. We take it very seriously. I think it is a big problem in South Africa, something that largely for many people goes undiagnosed. For many people, it's something they're not sure how to treat. Mm-hmm. They don't know where to get a social worker or a therapist to help them work through situations. And sometimes people have to realize, like, there's chemical elements to this that you don't just get rid of with therapy.
Mm-hmm.
You actually might need some other kind of treatment. Now, as a psychiatrist, this is what you deal with.
Mm.
And I'd like to just go through a few definitions, because we all talk about these words and these phrases and these ideas.
Mm.
We don't necessarily understand them. I mean, let's talk about the difference between a psychologist and a psychiatrist, for starters.
Okay. So maybe let me start with a psychiatrist because maybe that's the easiest one. Okay. So a psychiatrist is a medical doctor. So right. You're a medical doctor. So after your years of community service and you're an independent doctor, then, you know, you have an opportunity to go study further another 4 to 5 years, as a specialty in mental illness, you know, like other people do gynecology. Some right. people do surgery. You know, you could do mental, health and mental illnesses in that regard, and you become a psychiatrist.
Right.
But in your training, you also do psychotherapy. So what the psychologists do.
Yes.
So you also, do training in that, you know, in CBT, supportive therapy, all the modalities of therapy. But under supervision with a senior psychologist. And then a psychologist, you know, they focus mainly on, just the talk therapy, you know,
right.
So they're not medical doctors, so they can't
prescribe,
they can't prescribe medication, right. But obviously they do that, the therapy on a more in depth. It's more in depth, as compared perhaps to psychiatrists, because although we do both, you know, because we're doctors, you know, we lean sometimes towards more medicine than, mm-hmm. you know, the talk therapy.
Well, maybe you guys are primarily the, as you say, the medical doctors, and you understand the biology, whereas they're the people who you refer to, when you need the therapy.
Mm-mm.
And the psychoanalysis and all of that stuff. Okay, so let's get into some other things. Bipolar and schizophrenia. What are these? What are the variations on these? What do we need to understand about them if we are or if we know someone who's suffering from them?
All right. So bipolar illness is it's a mood disorder. Right. So now you have these persistent, you know, prolonged, mood symptoms over a period of time, you know, but with these mood symptoms comes, you know, changes in things that you do in your daily life. So they affect your sleep, your appetite, mm-hmm. your energy levels, and also your thought processes. Right. As opposed to, schizophrenia, which is mainly a psychotic disorder. So where it's primarily that your thought processes, are not in keeping with reality a lot. All right. So both of them is a chemical imbalance. Mm-hmm. All right. With schizophrenia, you know, there's excess of certain neurotransmitters in certain pathways. And because of this excess and imbalance in these neurotransmitters, you start, the brain starts misinterpreting things, in the world, you know, to be real to the patient, although they're unreal to all of us.
So they're not connected to reality most of the time.
No, they're not connected to reality.
Just to go back for a moment to bipolar, because a lot of people throw this term around like they mean, oh, someone just went from happy to sad. Now, what are the two parameters here? Is it mania and depression?
All right. So, it's depression. And mania, all right? But the two types of bipolar, mm-hmm. right? So it sort of works on a spectrum.
Okay.
So the depressive episodes are really, really bad, where, you know, there's this persistent low mood, no motivation. But it can also get to a point where it's so severe that you get the psychotic symptoms, all right?
Self-harm.
Yes, self-harm.
Suicidal.
Yeah, suicidal thoughts, homicidal ideation.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you get the other spectrum where you go now where the mood is quite elevated, quite irritable. You have excess energy levels. You know, you're not sleeping. You need only 2 hours of sleep and you feel refreshed. You know, you're almost on a go. It's almost like, you know, like an Energizer bunny with a little battery.
That sounds like me.
It's not necessarily happiness.
Yeah.
It's mania.
Yeah.
So this is the manic state.
It's just the manic state.
Okay, but the manic state does sound like, I'm not being funny here, but it sounds like me on most days.
Yeah, I think we can all identify with some parts of either the mania or the depression.
Both are bad, right?
I think it depends on how long it goes on for and how persistent it is.
It is, yeah.
Making it a chronic illness, meaning it's going on for months.
How do you treat someone who's bipolar? What do you do chemically and what you do in terms of therapy? Is there a therapeutic element to bipolar disorder?
Yes, for both, actually. For all psychiatric or mental illnesses, there is, right? So primarily the medication is to sort of balance out the chemistry, right? And once that is done, right, then, you know, there's room for psychotherapy, you know, whether it's supportive, whether it's psychoeducation, whether it's involving family.
And sometimes it's because people just want to understand what is actually going on.
What's
in
going
their heads.
On, yeah. Right. And that's the first step, you know, once you know what is going on in your brain, what is going on in your life, and we can help you make sense of that. Then,
so it would,
you know,
it would be a, like a mood stabilizer that you would take.
So, yeah,
for, I think it's epileptic drugs that are sometimes used for that.
All right. Yeah. So, for bipolar, the mood stabilizers, you know, traditionally the old ones, what the gold, what we call the golden standard is lithium. All right.
Right.
And then, our sort of second line is your mood stabilizers, right? So when you do Google them, they're traded as anticonvulsants. So your epileptic medication, your Epilim, your Tegretol.
What do these do inside the brain? I mean, what, I don't want to get too technical about it, but do they inhibit the transfer of chemicals at the synapses? Do they allow for more oxytocin, serotonin, what do they do?
All right. So essentially, you know, we have these primary neurotransmitters in your brain that control our moods, our thoughts, our memories, our motivation, you know, our sleep, right? So they sort of all go out of balance. So what the moods, like literally, they're stabilizing the mood. You know?
So it comes in and it balances everything.
It balances everything, you know. So at the neurotransmitter, then, you know, that's getting maybe a little bit more technical. We can block certain neuroreceptors. Sometimes we block the reuptake of those neurotransmitters. So it gets a little bit technical. But if I had to make an analogy, think about it like in a car. You know, this is like literally the gearbox. The mood stabilizer is making sure everything goes to gear one, then gear two, gear three, gear four. Like making like smooth running of things in the brain.
What about antidepressants?
All right.
What do those do?
All right. So the antidepressants, you know, they target mainly serotonin. So in patients with depression and anxiety, right, it was shown in research that they have low serotonin, or the serotonin is not working as it should. So what now the antidepressants are doing are increasing the serotonin around the synapses, all right, to sort of keep us happy, all right, keep your thought processes going and in check, and, you know, not erratic, to sort of control, you know, like in OCD, for instance, that, you know, they not become intrusive, you know, so that those thoughts are sort of also normalized, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's such a difficult balance to achieve. I myself am on various antidepressants and have been for 20 years.
Takes like a handful of them every morning.
And night. And you don't realize how often your mind, your state of mind or the chemicals in your mind change, and how often you need to revisit your script, because any occurrence in your day-to-day life can affect your brain chemicals, and it may mean that you need to adjust your medication. So, I mean, with me, for instance, the line for me is where I start to feel too numb and sort of really not caring about what goes on around me, then I know that something has to be adjusted, and we need more motivation in there. We need more upper.
More upper. All right.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And then, you know, if you had to think about it, our mood almost changes every minute, you know, to every hour. All right. And it's because these neurotransmitters constantly in our brain, they're getting released and taken back again, and put back in the synapses for the next time we need it, right? Like, for instance, the serotonin, for instance, in our brain, it's controlling our mood and our thoughts, but peripherally in the rest of our body, it's controlling our appetite. So a little bit of serotonin will get released in the morning and you feel hungry, all right, and you eat, right? And the serotonin, once you eat and you're satisfied, the serotonin gets taken back. You know, somebody upsets you, the brain doesn't like you staying upset, you know, because when you're on a low mood, your thoughts also tend to be negative, all right? So your brain will release a little bit of more serotonin to keep you happy, control those thoughts, and it gets taken back again, all right? But now in people with depression and anxiety, unfortunately, you know, that stays low for a long time. And that's where the antidepressants help, you know, to get the serotonin released. And unfortunately, because it keeps taken back again into your synapses, back into your neurons, that's why you need to take the medication every day. It doesn't last right. in your system.
Mm.
Like
it's not like you get enough and then you don't need anymore.
You don't need anymore.
Top
yeah.
it up. And then I've got enough airtime for the day.
Yeah. And then yeah. that in itself is an issue where people start to feel better and they think, right. I'm coming off the medication.
Mm.
And that can really be damaging because you need a month, it's sometimes more, to get used to a medication. And it can sometimes take up to a month to completely, you know, reverse. Mm. And so then you've messed with 2 months because you now have to go back onto it.
Mm.
And you've wasted time.
All right. Shit. Someone wants to know, because we've got a bunch of messages in here. And by the way, Doc, I don't expect you to answer all of these when you don't know the specifics. But Scott says, yeah. re-mental health. What about the benefits of fasting treatments or intermittent fasting, also diet and gut health? I mean, they have discovered there are links between some of these mental conditions and what you're eating, mm. right? I mean, what you put into the body,
mm.
you're gonna have an effect on mm. all the body, including the mental health.
Yeah, I think the biggest studies are actually coming out of Australia, where they're doing gut microflora. But essentially what they did, they put patients on different diets, like your Mediterranean diet, like a low carb and high fat diet, you know, and compared, you know, the depressive symptoms and the anxiety symptoms at the beginning mm-hmm. and at the end of treatment. I mean, there's still a long way to go, but you know, when we think about mental health, we think about it holistically. You know, we think about the biology, we think about what's happening psychologically, socially, you know, spiritually, your religion, every aspect of your being. And you know, is it really diet per se, or is it living a healthy lifestyle that's adding to you feeling better,
and
that helps the antidepressants?
People, yeah, I mean, a lot of people, I suppose, also have no purpose,
mm.
and that doesn't help you to find mental health and balance in your life.
Mm.
I mean, if you wake up in the morning, you've got nothing to wake up for.
Yeah.
That's mm. going to start
a huge, bad contributing
negative
factor.
Reinforcement, right?
Mm. And then also, if you don't have motivation to also get out of bed, then what people end up doing is that you eat whatever you see, or you get takeaways, you self-soothe with yeah. a lot of chocolate.
Yeah. You don't cook.
Yeah.
You need that instant gratification.
Mm.
So, you know, if there are eggs in the fridge, you're not necessarily going to cook eggs.
Mm.
You're rather going to take the easier route and have a piece of toast or boil 2 minute noodles, or, you know.
Yeah. That sounds really healthy.
Yeah.
So diet in that way, you know, can make the mental illness worse. Sometimes it can be better if you are eating healthy, because that's what we advocate, you know, a healthy lifestyle, you know, mm. even that taking a walk already in itself is therapeutic. Eating healthy on its own tells your mind, you're keeping me healthy, you know.
Because your body has a natural rhythm mm. and it does have that positive reinforcement too.
Mm.
Like if you're exercising, mm. it fires off the right chemicals, mm. gets the right things going. Keith says, I'm so happy you guys have got a specialist in to talk about mental health. There is so little understanding out there. And this psychiatrist had discussed it and explained it very well. I'm so impressed with you for tackling this topic. But the fact is, in South Africa, a lot of people do not like talking about mental health. There's a stigma.
Mm.
How do you deal with that?
You know,
I mean, what made you want to study it in the first place? I'm curious.
Like I was telling Sia earlier, you know, mental health, it's almost like the black sheep of medicine, mm. you know. Everybody shies away from it. Nobody wants to do it. But, I mean, you know, somebody has to do it. Somebody has to be a voice for the vulnerable population, you know. The vulnerable population, if you think about the world, you think about children and But what about the vulnerable adults? The vulnerable adults are the people that, you know, nobody wants to help. Everybody shoves them into a little box, you know. And I think that's what has sort of increased the stigma of mental illness. Nobody wants to talk about it.
Well, for most of human history, we used to take people who had anything slightly different from the rest of us mentally, and we'd put them in an institution.
Yeah, you quarantine them, you know.
Yeah.
You lobotomies don't want them- and you know, hysteria.
Straight jackets.
Removing of the womb.
Yeah.
We've treated mental illness really badly. It's only in the last 50 years or so that people have actually, I mean, look, you could go back to Freud and all that sort of thing, but really for 50 years or maybe even less, we've started to treat people seriously and to take them seriously.
I think we're taking them seriously now because people are not coping, you know, and people are taking away their lives. And that's what we're trying to prevent. I think if people know more, and they're not being discriminated against, you know, they will come out more. You know, when you have a flu, you know, you're not shy to say, I'm going to go see my GP or go see a doctor or I'm taking 3 days off.
Or gee, these flu meds are making you really sleepy.
Exactly. You know, and people will be more understanding, more compassionate if you're sleeping and you have a flu and you've taken maybe some Allergex or codeine. But, you know, when it's mental illness, everybody is, you know, tiptoes around you and things like that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, and it becomes like, so-and-so is not doing so well at work. Oh, it's that mental illness stuff again. People get irritated by it. They don't have patience for it.
So I think that's the drive around, you know, this psychoeducation and letting people know. Because people, I don't know, there's something in the society that makes you feel like you should be able to cope by yourself.
Be an adult.
Be an adult.
Do your stuff.
Snap out of it.
Snap, you know. But nobody ever says snap out of cancer. Nobody ever says snap out of that flu, you know. And I think that's the drive, you know. Make it as normal going to see a psychologist or a psychiatrist as you go see anybody else for anything that goes wrong in your body.
Yeah.
But Dr. Gwynne, it might seem like a very basic question to ask, but when do you know you might need help? You know, what if I'm just having a bad week as opposed to, okay, this might be a chemical issue in my brain and I need to get it checked out?
All right. So when it starts being a disorder, it means, you know, you're not snapping out of it, all right? Now, your functionality is starting to be affected. You're not as productive as you are, as you should be at work, all right? You know, that drive for your own personal care, you don't care about your own personal management anymore, all right? When it starts also affecting your relationships, you know, with other people, you know, then, you know, there's family problems, there's intimate partner issues, right? Relations with your children, relations with your colleagues. You know, if all of those are starting to get affected, it means it's just not just you, all right? It means now other areas of your life are starting to get polluted by this bad week. 'Cause now it's not a bad week anymore. It's a bad month. And it's month on month.
Yeah, it's a time thing.
It's a time thing
when it becomes chronic.
What are the most dangerous mental health issues you think in South Africa in particular? I mean, what are the things that worry you the most? Because we've talked a little bit about schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. There are obviously other much more dangerous situations that can occur, and people who, I'm loath to use the term, but when people go completely crazy and they start to harm themselves, harm others, they start to fall outside of society's normal and acceptable patterns. What do we call that, and how do we know how to deal with those people?
All right. So, I mean, I think all mental illnesses, all right, can get dangerous, all right, because they'll come to a point where each of, whether it's depression, whether it's anxiety, whether it's schizophrenia, whether it's bipolar illness, all right? When those thoughts start becoming negative and you direct those negative towards yourself, where you harm yourself,
right,
all right? Harm other people, damage property, or even put yourself in vulnerable situations where you can be taken advantage of others, it becomes dangerous. You know, I think the ones that are linked highly likely to high suicide rates are definitely depression, schizophrenia, and bipolar illness, right? And I think because it comes with the impulsivity, your thought processes, and especially with schizophrenia, let's make an example with the delusions, you know, these are like fixed false beliefs, you know, that are not in keeping with reality. Even if people challenge you, you know, conspiracy theories, people are out there to harm you. You know, the patients could start acting on those delusions and harm themselves or harm other people. And they don't have the mental capacity to comprehend what is happening. They may have delusions, auditory hallucinations, for instance, where they're hearing voices or visual hallucinations, things that are not there, and they act towards that, you know, thinking it's real. It's real to them, remember, but it's not real to us.
And like they think they're there to save the world, or they think they're there. Like they've got superpowers.
Exactly. Yeah. And another thing that we're not talking about a lot, it's substances, right? A lot of substances, alcohol, cannabis, your upper drug, your uppers, you know, your ecstasy, crystal meth, and all those other drugs, right? In society, you know, they're cool to use, but, you know, they're bringing on all these illnesses much quicker. And they're making them much more severe, and people use them.
So people who take these drugs might not always, but they could have, that could provide a trigger for some mental health issues.
Well, that, and also, I don't think patients are necessarily always honest with their therapist when it comes to their recreational drug use. And that creates, that upsets the apple cart completely, where you've now provided someone with, an anti-convulsion drug, and they're taking
alcohol.
And they're drinking alcohol. There's some antidepressants that could lead to death if you combine them with certain drugs or alcohol.
Is that so?
There's some that we're wary of, especially if you have other medical illnesses. You know, let's say you're on warfarin, for instance, and you take one of the antidepressants, they can make the bleeding tendencies much worse off. And then you know, you could end up with like hemorrhages and all of those things. So there's a reason, we always tell patients, please inform us of anything that you're taking, from any other healthcare professional, anything that you're taking over the counter, because they can interact with the medication and actually worsen off things. And the other medication that will warn off the patients, that, you know, please look out for X, Y, and Z with this medication, because you could have an adverse event, you know, that could lead to death or something like that. So it's very important that patients, you know, do discuss honestly with their doctors what they're taking. And often then what people do, you know, with the stigma, because nobody wants to seek out help, or you sit with the problem long and then you start self-medicating. Let's say with depression, you start, you know, not being able to sleep at night, then it's one glass of wine, then it becomes a bottle of wine. By the time you come and get help, now, not only do you have to deal with the depression, now you have to also deal now that you have a substance use disorder, but the alcohol has made the depression worse. And then as the depression got worse, you started grabbing onto other illnesses. You started getting some anxiety with that. You started getting some obsessive compulsive symptoms. You started panic attacks, some ADHD symptoms. So, you know, by the time now you come, you are so much worse off.
You're
so complex. You know?
I mean, Candace says, I'm so glad you guys are chatting about this. I've struggled with my, with depression and hormone imbalances my whole life. I love that people are now able to talk about it, and it's not the taboo subject it was when I was younger. So you see.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I remember, being in one of my first long-term relationships, and, I had to have him accompany me to the psychiatrist because that was the only way he would understand that I wasn't making this up.
Yeah, it's so unfortunate that we still have that kind of stigma.
You know, when you have a broken leg, everyone knows that.
Yeah.
But That was 20 years ago where there were people who didn't believe me at all.
Yeah, unfortunately. And I think that's a drive around psychic education that, you know, people only recognize mental illness when things are much worse off. So when you have bipolar illness and or like a psychotic disorder like schizophrenia, when you're walking around naked on the highway, you know, singing on top of the roof or doing really...
Basically weekend stuff.
You know.
Yeah, all right.
Just a normal Saturday morning.
You know, this organized thing. That people recognize it, you know, but we, the drive around psychic education is that let's nip it in the bud when it's still like evolving. And then we can change the prognosis, of these illnesses and make anybody with mental illness a productive member of society.
I mean, isn't it true also that a lot of this stuff stems from people who really were not raised in optimal conditions? I mean, I suppose in South Africa, we have countless examples of kids who are raised where perhaps they don't have a parent or both parents, where they don't have the right nutrition and care when they're young, where they don't necessarily have access to medical professionals. They might be abandoned. They might be left to their own devices at a very young age. They might be abused. All of this contributes to a general illness of the mentality of many people, right?
That is true, but also we have what we call the environmental risk. So even if you don't have the family history of a mental illness, even if you didn't, there were no infections, the mom didn't have stresses, you were not abandoned, you lived quite a productive life, happy, normal childhood, you could still have mental illness between the ages of 18 to 40, you know. So, yes, when those odds are against you and you've had that, you know, your risk of mental illness is much higher. But it doesn't mean that...
some people are immune.
Some people are immune to it,
That's the classic case of she's got everything that she could wish for, you know. She's successful, she's got money, she's pretty, she's all of these things. She has no reason to be sad.
Exactly. And I think if we had to make examples, especially of celebrities, especially the comedians, you know.
Comedians are a big one.
You know, it's maybe like the famous one, I forgot his name, the one who passed away by suicide.
Robin Williams.
Yeah. You know, he had everything going for him, you know. And nobody expected, and I think because nobody expected it, you know, he probably sat there suffering for a long time because nobody was expecting that from him, you know.
Yeah.
And you suffer alone, and then depression is like an isolating disease, you know. All mental illnesses, even with the schizophrenia, when the thought process are starting to change, that can present a lot like anxiety at the beginning, a lot like depression, especially the negative symptoms of schizophrenia, you know, because you have this motivation, you almost become emotionally unexpressive. You feel, you know, they look cold and aloof. They don't want to tend to their personal care. You know, they also get into this deep depression where they don't want to do anything. So illnesses like schizophrenia can look like depression and anxiety at the beginning. And it's usually during those times that most patients are at risk of using substances, right? And now the substances, especially cannabis, has been shown and linked to those psychotic illnesses much later on.
Yikes.
Especially if you're using cannabis at a young age, in your early teenage years, that can change your mental chemicals forever.
Forever.
Wow. I mean, this has been fascinating, Doc. It feels like it's been 2 minutes, but we've been talking for half an hour. So, I mean, thank you so much for coming. It's always good to have the real professionals and experts here to help us understand and unpack these issues. And we may call on you again, if that's okay.
It's just nice to know that there are people who completely understand.
Right. It's a pleasure. And I think if people want more information, you know, they can visit schizophrenia24x7.co.za to find out a lot about schizophrenia.
Schizophrenia 24 by seven.
Yes.
Okay.
.co.za. And also SADC, you know, South African Depression and Anxiety Group. I think there's a lot of advocacy work. And if people want more information, please use those resources. Visit your healthcare workers, you know, visit your clinics.
Well, Sean says here in the messages, I have my first session with my head doctor tomorrow. I'm really scared.
I think a lot of times people are scared because they think, I'm going to be given medication and my personality is going to change forever.
Yeah. And some people also worry that they might get addicted to the medication, you know, physiologically medications like antidepressants, for instance, you physiologically cannot get addicted to them. But medication like your sleeping tablets, however, you know, those can get addictive, but those are the things that your doctor will discuss with you.
Right.
And they shouldn't change your personality. If your personality is changing, it's because perhaps certain coping skills and certain things are starting to change. And we want people to cope in a much healthier way and not cope in those unhealthy ways that they used to before. Mm. You know, those are the personality changes that we would like to start seeing if that's what he's scared about. You know, good changes.
All right, Sean. Good luck, man. And thank you so much. Dr. Gwen, it's a pleasure to have you here. We talked a little bit about mental health today, and you can hear the rest if you missed a part of it by listening to the podcast later on. That's Dr. Gwen Tonyani. She's a psychiatrist, and she's our guest this morning. Thanks for joining us. We will see you tomorrow between 6 and 8 o'clock. Keep it on cliffcentral.com today for more.
This is CliffCentral.com.